Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Nachtigall. I'm here in the community radio station studio. We're here around the kitchen table, and we're going to have a lot of good things to talk about today. This is community radio. This is put together by a lot of good people and a lot of good volunteer time and a lot of our friends, and here's one of them. Support for this show comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames. Community-owned, community-focused since 1974, open daily 7 to 9. Located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op, and we do. So welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. Who says that we can't get a thunderstorm in December? We had quite a doozy the past weekend, didn't we? Local rivers are running full, our fields are soggy. I hope you're all high and dry. After a weekend of rain and gray and gloomy skies, I'm sort of looking forward to a little snow, at least a little for Christmas. Please, maybe. All right. Today on the Donalana Kitchen, we're going to talk about cheese and visit a new business on Main Street that's designed to cater to our favorite four-legged friends. And we'll also consider a holiday drink that has an interesting all-American history. My co-host here on the Donalana Kitchen, Donna, is in New Zealand. Besides sending pictures of sunshine and beaches, she does send her holiday greetings, and we'll be hearing some audio reports from Down Under after Christmas. So we'll look forward to hearing from her. With me in the kitchen today is Connie Lawrence. You may know her as the cheese buyer or the cheese lady at Wheatsfield. She's got a lot to say about cheese. And this kind time of year is a good time to think of celebrating the holidays with something so absolutely wonderful. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen, Connie.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
So how did you fall into cheese? How did you get started?
Well, I actually fell into cheese by accident. Back in the 90s, I was active in the local food movement, was actually owned a CSA at my home, and throughout a long process, long story, met a couple of women who not only were CSA customers, but they became dear friends and mentors to my children who were raising goats for 4-H. It was a good time for me to look for a new project as my kids were leaving home, and one thing led to another. They were, my friends Kathy Larson and Wendy Mickle, were actually experimenting with making cheese and considering selling milk, trying to figure out what they could do. They had a pretty good size herd of goats, and they wanted to do something more constructive with the goats to give them a reason to keep all of them. They're very fond of the goats, and those of us who knew us at that time knew them as the goat moms. Well, we cooperated, formed a corporation, and in 2000 started Northern Prairie Chev, which was a goat cheese company located by Woodward. And that's how I really got interested in making cheese. Took a short course at the University of Wisconsin to learn how to make cheese. And we got started towards the end of that year, and one of our first customers, interestingly enough, was Wheatsfield. They've always been very supportive of the local food movement, mm-hmm. and they were really good friends to us, and that's how we began.
Oh, that's wonderful. I remember you and Prairie Chev at the Ames Farmers Market.
Yes.
And getting people to taste goat cheese. I love goat cheese. Some people are a little taken off by it because they think all cheese must come from cows, but cheese can be made from a lot of different things.
Yes, we always used to smile because people would come up to us at the market. We sold here in Ames and Des Moines, and they would say, oh, goat cheese, is it any good? You would say, well, yes, obviously, because we're here, it's good. But It's just cheese from a different kind of milk. Mm-hmm. Throughout history, goat cheese is probably produced and sold more throughout the world than other forms of milk cheese. We in the U.S. have more affiliation with cow's milk cheese. That's what we're comfortable with. That's what we have more of. Frankly, you get a lot more milk from one animal. A cow produces a lot more milk. It's easier to take care of a cow. In that regard, it takes a lot of goats to produce very much milk.
Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, if you're in a country where feeding a large cow might be a problem, goats are a bit hardier in a country where they have to fend for themselves.
And they're smaller animals, so people like us, women, are much more easily able to handle a goat than a big, huge cow.
User-friendly.
Yes.
What kind of goats did you have in that herd?
We had all Nubians. Mm-hmm. Nubians are the ones that are a little larger animals. They have long ears, very sweet personalities, very intelligent, and very chatty. They're
chatty.
Known for being chatty. What is wonderful for cheese making is that they have very sweet milk. They don't have a lot of different enzymes. They do have different enzymes in cow's milk, but they don't have a real strong taste. So the milk tends to be a little sweeter flavor. It's also high in butter fat, so you have a lot of richness in the milk. Makes really good cheese.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. So how does cheese work?
Cheese throughout history has really been a way to preserve milk. If you think about cheese, it's kind of an interesting concept because it's a way of removing the solid parts from the water. And you think of milk as a liquid, it's kind of hard to envision that. But we're talking about protein, butter fat, calcium, other minerals. And throughout the cheese making process, you're actually separating that from the water, which is the whey. Various ways of going about that, but most cheeses start with warming the milk. So milk needs to be warm. Adding a cheese culture, which is typically a form of bacteria. And that culture is what actually designates what kind of cheese you're making. There are several strains of bacteria that are used. Some are specific for different kinds of cheeses that are blended together, as a matter of fact. You add that bacteria to the milk, and if you want a colored cheese, you'd also add the color. Real fresh white cheddar has no color.
Right. I was going to ask about that. Some cheddar is orange, some
yes.
cheddar is white, and it's just
It's for the eye.
All right.
And
all
some
right.
of it is tradition. There is an English cheese called Red Leicester that's very red colored and is dyed red, but that's the tradition.
Oh, my goodness.
So it adds nothing to the taste. It's just the appearance.
And you talked about these cultures. Is it like a sourdough or a yeast culture? It's kind of on
the same order, but it is more of a bacteria.
Okay.
And that bacteria determines the type of cheese. That is allowed to basically grow in the milk. And if you're going to have a blue cheese, which is a different culture, it's a penicillin, so you're having a mold added at the same time, then you'd add that. And then after that has a chance to develop in the milk, you add rennet. And rennet is an enzyme, can be either animal or vegetable derived, that actually coagulates the milk. That's what actually causes it to become firm. And it's when it is set, is what it's called. It almost looks like a real firm Greek yogurt. It's real firm to the touch. Then you start a process of cutting and heating and stirring till it gets to the right temperature, the right pH, generally fairly acidic. And then you have a choice, for example, if you're making Colby or cheddar, same process is all those steps exactly the same. And with Colby, you'd rinse those curds. With cheddar, you do the cheddaring process.
Ooh.
So two different ways of approaching that.
The cheddaring process.
Yes. Which is basically a way to make the cheese. Number one, it knits together. The curds knit together. And you're separating the whey. And if you're in a large company, you're separating it onto two sides of the big vat. And then it's a process of cutting that in big chunks, layering those chunks, and continuing to turn them. So there's some pressure on the curds.
The curds, are they pressed.
Or just by the natural weight.
Just by their own weight.
I
figured, okay.
So they're like big right. slabs.
Right, right. I've seen the big slabs, but I thought, well, there's all these curds. They must have a way of like physically squishing them together.
You know, they do later, but this actually is the cheddaring process. It's basically steaming and allowing the pH to drop, so it's fairly acidic. Mm-hmm. Then when it gets to the right point, which takes a bit of time, then they do what's called milling or cutting up the curds. And if you've had fresh cheese curds, that's the end point for those.
That's where the cheese curds come from.
That's where the cheese curds come from. If that is not the end point for those, then it goes into a mold and a press. Ah. And then that forms the shape, which can be small or large. And then after a period of time, it's then removed from the press and it ages. And then that's a whole other process.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's amazing. It is a dynamic process. Things are changing. I remember I grew up in Wisconsin, so I'm a real fan of cheese curds, but I'm also a persnickety fan of cheese curds. I expect cheese curds to be really, really fresh so they squeak.
Yes.
And I know that the next day even, they're different. There's a change going on. They're aging.
Yes.
More and more. So that's pretty amazing.
And it is interesting. It's actually surface tension on the outside of the curds caused by adding the salt at the right point. So when you bite into it, you actually have a little resistance on that curd, and that's the squeak.
That's the squeak.
Yeah. It's very interesting.
I didn't know how they put in the squeak, and now I do. That's good. So what defines cheese? What is a cheese? Any milk that's gone through this process?
Pretty much. There's all kinds of cheese, everything from cream cheese, soft spreadable things, to an aged Parmesan that's very hard. Basically, there's not a distinct classification system for cheeses. I like to think of cheeses in terms of moisture, like a soft spreadable, a semi-soft, kind of a medium soft, to aged, and then your hard aged cheeses. In my mind, that seems to make the most sense. With something that's soft and spreadable, obviously that's things you cook with, your cream cheeses, your quark, your chèvre, different things like that. Your semi-soft would be like a mozzarella that you would shred and use for pizza, or maybe a Colby. Your next level up would be the medium soft, medium hard, would be like a cheddar, a semi-aged product. And then, of course, the Parmesan and the aged Goudas and those things are very hard for grating.
There are some cheeses that melt well and others that maybe don't. Or actually, there are some cheeses that taste really good cooked or melted or browned a little bit.
Yes, most of them in my mind are that way. Not every single one, but most of them, yes. Higher moisture cheeses are going to melt a little easier.
Than
your really hard cheeses. Parmesan will melt, but it's not going to be the gooey, oozing cheese that you think of like with some of the other soft cheeses.
What's the best way to store a cheese? Different kinds? Are the cheeses still in a dynamic process? Are they still aging after you buy them from the grocery store?
They are constantly, yes. Your fresh cheeses should actually be eaten fairly soon. Okay. They have a lot of moisture, and they are going to develop bacteria over a period of time, and they can spoil if you don't eat them relatively soon. The aged cheeses will continue a process of basically breaking down, shall we say, which is kind of an odd thing to think of. But it's aging, breaking down, mellowing. The proteins are kind of starting to separate.
But they're edible. They're fine.
Edible. We have cheddars that are 7-8 years old.
Yes, I've heard of that.
And even mold on the surface is perfectly fine. Even government regulations suggest if you cut that off or scrape that off, it's perfectly fine to eat. You do not ever want to eat anything that has veins of pink because that's a dangerous bacteria you don't eat. And even a blue cheese is safe to eat as long as it's not brown or pink.
Ooh, okay.
Yes.
Remember that, folks.
Mostly brown.
Brown or pink. Well, at this stage, there would be an odor with this or maybe not?
Well, and some cheeses are supposed to be stinky. So it's some of its personal taste.
Oh, dear.
But most of the things that are dangerous to consume, we'll let you know.
Okay. Can cheeses be frozen?
Some cheeses can be. Most should not be. If it's a real high moisture cheese, a cream cheese, for example, is fine.
Okay.
If it is a mozzarella that you're going to shred first and put in the freezer, that's not a problem because you're going to use it as a crumbled cheese.
Okay.
If you freeze a cheddar, it's going to denature the protein, and when you thaw it out, it's going to fall apart.
Oh, my goodness.
So if you don't care if it falls apart, okay. If it's feta, you don't care if it crumbles, it's fine.
Okay.
But there's really not a lot of point to freezing those things because they're going to keep.
Okay, that's right. Okay.
And that's the one point I think growing up I never understood is that a cheese is really very safe food. It was originated as something that could be kept for periods of time, particularly the low moisture cheeses. Mm-hmm. They can keep for a long period of time even without refrigeration.
That's right, because cheeses have been around much longer than refrigerators.
Absolutely. They're in the Bible. The early Romans actually did a great job with manufacturing cheeses. Very innovative people. Cheeses have been around a long time.
Oh, that's fantastic. And now we're moving into the holidays. What a fine time to think of cheeses. What are some of the fancy sort of, you mentioned that there are seasonal, only this time of year cheeses.
Yes, we have seasonal cheeses for a couple of reasons. One, some things are only manufactured for this time of year, and we have to plan well in advance so that they can – to order those like in June so that they are ready to produce them. And we also have some that are seasonal because of the milk production is seasonal. So we have some things that are available. For example, a fresh chèvre is more likely to be found locally in the summer and not in the winter because of the natural cycle of the goats not producing in the winter.
That's right. Animals need a time off, too.
Yes, they do. But right now we have a really exciting collection of cheeses for the holidays. We have everything from goat milk, sheep milk. We have cow's milk cheeses. We have things that are very interesting that we can only get right now. We have a delightful goat cheese from Spain that is packed with thyme on the outside. Delicious. We have a sheep milk cheese from Spain that's been soaked in Syrah wine, which is also really delicious. And just a whole wide variety of things with fruit. The cranberry cheese is particularly good this time of year.
That's a good combination.
Yeah.
We'll come back to more wonderful food tastes in a little bit. I want to remind you, you are listening to KHOI 89.1. This is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. I'm here in the kitchen talking to Connie Lawrence about cheese for the holidays. Cheese! We were talking about good tastes, good holiday cheeses. What are some fine things that you might want to have on your holiday table, or maybe just on a buffet sideboard for people to nibble on? It's that time of year. I'm in the kitchen here with Connie Lawrence, and she's going to tell us.
Actually, it's really nice to have a variety. And at the co-op, by the way, we do have a tool that is really useful. We have a little brochure here. It's called Build a Perfect Cheese Plate, which talks a little bit about what kind of varieties you might be interested in, how to choose things, for example, by the milk. It's nice to have a variety of milk-type cheeses, milk selections. If I'm putting together a cheese plate for myself, for example, I like to have at least 3 to 5 different kinds of cheeses. Depending upon your audience, you don't necessarily have large amounts or upscale cheeses. It can be very simple, kind of everyday within those choices. It's fun to have different colors so that you don't have all white or all yellow. There's things with peppers. There are choices that are colored. There are choices pure white.
You mentioned the cranberry ones for the holidays, and that's very nice.
Absolutely. Blue cheese is always a nice addition, and there are several choices in blue these days. Also, textures. It's nice to have a variety of textures so that you don't feel like you're eating just one type of cheese. There's so many other choices, there's no reason not to. In addition to that, it's interesting to think about who your audience is that you're serving to. Is this a family activity? If you have a lot of children, you're going to want to think about more everyday cheeses and maybe cut them up in smaller pieces so that you have everything accessible. Everyone can help themselves. If it's a buffet particularly, you want to have things ready. People could just serve themselves. If it is a fancy party or maybe a smaller group, a wine and cheese tasting perhaps, or an hors d'oeuvre type of gathering, then it's really fun actually to have different shapes, different sizes, different types. Something with herbs on the outside always looks really pretty. On a slate board, on a wooden cutting board, something simple but decorative with a separate knife or serving item for each cheese, and just let people help themselves. It looks more interesting. It tastes more interesting. One thing I always have as a rule, though, make sure you have one simple cheese that would appeal to everybody no matter what, because you don't want to have all stinky cheeses, for example, or all blues, because not everybody likes that. But a nice middle-of-the-road cheddar or Gouda, something that everybody would enjoy, always a good idea no matter what.
That sounds like a good idea.
And then on the side, things people don't normally think about with cheese, nuts, olives, fruit pastes. We have a lot of fruit pastes that are choices, something kind of tangy, pickles, pickled fruits, pickled meats, all different kinds of things are a really nice accompaniment to the cheese.
Oh, yes. And then have either a bit of bread or a variety of crackers to go with this.
Absolutely.
Could just nibble your whole evening.
You can have a whole meal right there. Simple and easy.
That's a good idea. And also, cheeses can sort of dry out if you cut them out. And so I suppose if you're going to prepare a cheese plate or a cheese board and cut them up, at least cover them up beforehand.
Yes.
Or keep them in the refrigerator until the last minute, perhaps?
Or are
some cheeses better eaten kind of room temperature?
Some cheeses are better at room temperature. Now, I prefer things like brie, for example, to be a little cooler, personal choice. The flavor is going to be a little richer, more intense if it's at room temperature. If you have an aged cheese like Prairie Breeze, for example, it's our Iowa cheese that's kind of my gold star cheese. That is absolutely delicious. It is almost like a blend between a Parmesan and a cheddar. It has a little bit of sweetness to it. But if you cut it cold from the fridge, it's going to crumble.
Ah.
So this type of cheese is better let actually sit out for at least a half hour. So warm a little bit to room temperature is going to bring out the flavor more, and it's going to be so much easier to work with.
These sort of things might be things you might want to ask your cheese lady around the in the store when you buy this sort of thing. More and more people are getting more and more knowledgeable about this sort of thing. It's nice to know how to deal with cheese. Yes, it is. You mentioned Prairie Breeze as a local producer. Local, they're from Iowa, right?
Yes, yes. They're from Milton Creamery. Milton Creamery is in southern Iowa, Milton, Iowa, actually. It's owned by the Musser family, that is Mennonite. They actually source all their milk from local farmers, pretty much in the Amish and Mennonite community. It's kind of a medium-sized company, but these are extremely innovative, intelligent people, very hardworking. They not only make cheese themselves, but they bring in cheese from other small farms. From Missouri right now, they have a goat cheese, and there is a smoked cow milk cheese from two different places in Missouri that they bring in. They're two raw cheeses. They bring in at 60 days. They age them in a separate location, and then they market them.
Ah.
The people that make them originally do not have resources for marketing. Amish mm-hmm. people mm-hmm. in southern Missouri have a challenge marketing. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. this is networking and working together.
And we can enjoy it here.
Absolutely.
Very good. Very good. There's also another local person that you mentioned, local creamery, and this the best name in the world, Dairy Air. Oh, yes.
Yes.
Tell me about them.
Reichardt's Dairy Air by Knoxville. Lois Reichardt is a very innovative, hardworking woman. She is making extremely complex and interesting cheeses from her own goats, and she's also sourcing sheep milk from one of her neighbors. The only downside is that she's very seasonal, so the best time to actually get her cheeses would be in the summer and fall. Mm-hmm. We do have some of them available right now. She has gone to France and Italy and actually has studied cheese making up close with people there, does some extremely interesting things, and always a good source.
Good. And she is seasonal because, like we said before, her animals take the winter off.
Yes, they do. And so does she. Well deserved.
That's nice. That's nice. We can learn to eat like that. Enjoy her cheese in the summertime. Are there any other local producers that you've visited or that you deal with?
Iowa does not have a huge amount of cheesemakers, but we do have some really good cheesemakers. We have Frisian Farms down by Oskaloosa that make a really good Gouda cheese. And we have a newer company from Waukon, which makes a very traditional cheddar and cheddar curds. Hmm. They also do sell their milk. Wheatsville doesn't carry their milk, but I know they do sell milk and ice cream. But their cheddar is extremely good. It's very rich and creamy. It's white. I consider it more of an everyday kind of a cheddar. It's something that would appeal to almost everybody, and they've been really good to work with.
Very good. These small producers, three cheers to all of them who venture into this field, they tend to concentrate just on making one sort of cheese. You mentioned, or do they? Are once your creamery is set up to do one kind of cheese, is it hard to branch out and do other things?
In some ways, it's almost easier to make more selection when you're small.
Ah.
Because the equipment is extremely expensive, and if you're gearing towards all cheddar production, mm-hmm. for example, you'd have all your equipment geared to that, mm-hmm. which would be a huge investment. If you're small and you can make small batches of things, then that leads you into the opportunity to make different kinds of things.
You can use the same equipment to make lots of different things.
You would need less big, expensive equipment, and you have the option of fabricating a few things to make small batches of things. Mm-hmm. You could make lots of interesting cheese on a budget if you wanted to and you had the opportunity to. Yes.
That sounds like it would be fun.
Lois makes actually everything from a fresh chèvre. That's the majority of her cheese. Mm-hmm. But she also makes a very complex mold-ripened or like layered cheeses, like tortas. Her Robiolas and different things, feta, that all require not a lot of equipment. The biggest thing would be the molds that the curds are ladled into, mm-hmm. and then the weight of the curds allows them to form the shape, and then they're aged in a separate location. Her biggest barrier would be the aging area as long as you have that separated from the fresh cheeses, you know, you have lots of opportunities.
Oh, very good. These things all sound like labors of love.
Yes.
Very good. Have you, I know Weisfield Co-op has cooking classes. Has there been cheese cooking or cheese using classes? Have you given classes?
Yes, actually, several. And a couple of them, I'll back up a little bit, were really fun because we were able to find videos that showed in Ireland and in Italy some of the local cheese producers. They took you out onto the farms. They were really vivid and colorful. And at the end of each video, we all said, wow, can we go there? And in addition, then we sampled some of the cheeses that were shown on the video. So that was really a fun. It wasn't necessarily a class as much as it was an experience, which is kind of like
a cheese party.
Cheese
travelogue. Yes.
Exactly. Well, we have done some classes, and now with the expansion that we're right in the middle of, we have the opportunity to have a dedicated class space, which we haven't had before. And I did want to share our new mission statement is called Offering Food Services and Education to Support the Health of the Environment and Community. So there's a real focus on education. And I'm really excited to be part of that. I know that there will be a demo kitchen in the new space. There'll be a separate entrance. I have been told about some of the interesting ideas. It hasn't all been completely figured out. Now, some of it kind of develops as it goes. But there are just lots of opportunities coming, and it is not just for members. You don't have to be a member to come to a class. You just have to sign up and come and participate.
The cooking classes have really been a success. Right now, the cooking classes happen right kind of on the other end of the checkout space. And yes, there is space there in the seating area for the deli. But what seems whenever there's a cooking class, the chairs are full. So there has been that's wonderful. And it's not just cheese, of course. There's all kinds of subjects that people come and talk about. And it's really lovely that this is an expanding thing. People care about food.
Absolutely. And that's a major part of what Weisfield is about, is sharing and educating and hoping to include more people in that.
Very good. And at last time I looked, the parking lot renovations at the store are done, so it's a little easier to get around.
Yes, we have a little bit more to finish up around the edge, but it is so nice.
Oh,
just
good.
More room, get everybody in there. It's cleaner. It's just so nice.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Oh, we're talking during the break. A little back to holiday ideas. You mentioned something about a cheese rabbit for the holidays, or a rabbit something. What to do? Here's another interesting thing to do.
Yes. Back in earlier times, this was a story that I was told that when we didn't have a whole lot of money, and you had lots of little scraps of cheese lying about. Rather than worry about, you know, something fancy, you just throw all those little scraps of cheese into a pot with a little flour, some butter, perhaps a little cream, a little milk, whatever you had on hand. Make a sauce, basically, melt everything together, and dip bread in that. In fact, it's even better with day-old bread because you want the bread to be a little firmer. So if you didn't have much money or you want to just have a party and do something fun, throw it all together a little bit on the order of a fondue, but it doesn't have to be quite that fancy.
Ah, very good.
Yes.
Very
and good. If you're like me, we have lots of little scraps in the fridge. It's fun to just throw them all together and have something interesting.
Good. Put it in a pretty bowl and call it a holiday.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you for joining us today, Connie. This has been Connie Lawrence talking to us about cheese. She's the cheese lady at Weisfield Co-op. Very good.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You are listening to KHOI Community Radio. Community Radio for the heart of Iowa. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We talk about food and lots of other stuff here. And if you want to hear more about this sort of thing, go to khoifm.org. Find out what's going on in this fine radio space right here. We humans have a special connection to our pets. Fido and Puff sometimes even have their own Christmas stockings hanging on the mantle along with the rest of the family. I visited a new store on Main Street in Ames, Iowa, to find out what's on the holiday menu for the dogs and cats in our lives. I'm here in downtown Ames at the business called Treats on a Leash, and I'm talking to Michael Morris. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
What got you going on Treats on a Leash? It's a lovely business pertaining to food for our favorite animals.
Well, we had thought about a business like this for a long time, and we wondered why Ames didn't have one. We had two dogs at the time, and we would drive to Ankeny and go to the pet bakeries down there to get a special treat for our dogs. And then we lost one of our dogs in September of last year, and that's when we really started thinking seriously about it. I had a lot of retail experience. I was looking to retire in a few years. Barb had been working from home, but we always had a passion for animals, and we decided to go for it. And with some help from the small business office at Iowa State, they helped us put a business plan together, and we found this wonderful location on Main Street, and here we are 10 months later, and we're very happy with how it's gone so far.
That's great. Or how does one bake for a dog?
Well, we don't bake on site, but we work with a wonderful dog bakery in Coralville. Their treats are amazing, so they supply our bakery treats. And we get some of our bulk treats from them as well. And then for the bulk treats, we work with two other Midwest bakeries. And they're all healthy, all natural, no preservatives.
Amazing flavors. I almost want to start biting into them myself. Can you tell me some of the flavors you have?
A couple of them have peanut butter. Dogs love peanut butter, so that's a good choice. There's pumpkin ginger. There's sweet potato. There's cheesy goldfish. There's bacon and cheddar. There's cinnamon swirls. They're all made with human-grade ingredients. And there's one called Canine Cookies. It's a dog version of a Toll House cookie. And we've actually tried that one ourselves. And it's not bad. But the cookies have carob chips in them because dogs can't have chocolate. The bakery treats are decorated with yogurt. And like I said, they're all natural, all healthy, no preservatives.
That's wonderful. For any of us that have dogs, we realize they're worth everything we shower on them. And it's nice to give them a little treat every now and then. Dogs used to just be given table scraps or whatever was left. What sort of things do dogs get now?
People are becoming better informed about dog food. We treat our dogs like family. We want to give them the best possible food. We want to give them a long, healthy life. The dog food that we carry is high quality. It's well rated. We go by Dog Food Advisor, which is a good resource. We carry a good variety and a variety of price points as well. The trend in dog foods is really grain-free is real popular.
Yeah, what way is that?
Some dogs are sensitive to grain. So a lot of people are switching their dogs to a grain-free diet. And actually, it's not the grains that are so bad. It's the binding agents that are used when they process the grains. Actually, when you think about it, before dogs were domesticated, grain wasn't part of their diet. Their diet was meat. So that's why you see dog foods now with higher protein values and the grain-free diets. Probably 80% of the dog food that we sell is grain-free.
Do you do cat food too?
Yes, we have cat food as well. We had requests for cat food early on, so we brought it in. A lot of our customers have dogs and cats, so they come in looking for cat items as well. Yeah, we do have a lot of customers that buy both for dogs and cats.
Do you find cats eating dog food and dogs eating cat food? That's what usually happens at most houses.
We've heard of that. In fact, dogs love cat food because it's richer. And it's not necessarily healthier for them, but dogs will eat cat food if they get the chance. And we encourage people to bring their dogs in. Some dogs will go right to the bulk table and sniff at the baskets.
Good. Oh, good.
And nine times out of ten, their owner ends up buying that toy for them.
Barbecue ribs. Can you tell the ingredients for that?
Well, those are made with flour, oats, canola oil, brewer's yeast, and beef broth. And they're covered in a sauce made with molasses, yellow mustard, and vinegar. It almost sounds good enough for me to eat.
We're coming up to the Christmas season. What's a big item that people are buying for their pets for Christmas?
Well, we sell a lot of Christmas toys, reindeer, moose, things like that. We also have antlers that you can put on your dog. I'm not sure how many dogs will leave them on. But we have Christmas sweaters as well and Christmas pajamas.
I love seeing dogs in Christmas sweaters. They're so cute. How did you come up with the name Treats on a Leash?
We wanted a name that was unique, that described our business. We came up with names, and then we searched on the Internet to see if anybody was using those. And we threw out probably 24 names before we found one that wasn't being used. And I came up with the name Treats on a Leash.
Who is the dog on the cover here? Who is your spokes dog?
This was inspired by our dog, Belle, our Basset Hound that we lost last September, a year ago. We had the logo designed locally here by First Class Signs, and they did an awesome job on it.
Wonderful, wonderful. And you are this is a one-of-a-kind shop. You're not part of a big chain of shops either, are you?
No, we're strictly a mom-and-pop shop.
So there's Michael and Barb. They're the mom-and-pop for the cats and dogs. And we appreciate having them on Main Street.
Woof, we're back. Tom and Jerry's. Tom and Jerry's. It's a traditional holiday drink. And it is not, as I thought, related to the popular MGM cartoon, nor is it named for the KHOI board member Tom Beal and his brother Jerry? No, 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 no. We found out that it is named instead by a person called Pierre Egan, who was an English writer who wrote a book called Life in London, or The Day and Night Scenes of Jerry Hawthorne and His Elegant Friend Corinthian Tom. And he also wrote a play. This was in 1821 called Tom and Jerry or Life in London. And that drink came out of that time. Let's hear more about Tom and Jerry's. We're here in the Donalana kitchen with Cynthia McClure. We're going to be talking about a traditional holiday drink. Cynthia, welcome.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here on your show.
Good. You have a drink you'd like to talk about, Tom and Jerry's. It's a fascinating sort of history. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
If you Google it, it's really an interesting drink. It's quintessentially American drink, and they use this drink as an advertising technique to advertise a play.
Now, A play.
It was in the mid-1800s sometime. I don't know the exact dates, but it's an interesting recipe. The timing of this was when, imagine not having an electric mixer and you had to mix everything by hand. So this is when Jell-O was considered an exotic food because you had to take the hooves and everything and render it.
This is pre-Jell-O. This is gelatin.
Gelatin.
Yeah, okay.
This is that kind of, so these recipes go back, I wouldn't say a long time, but for America, they go back a long time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So to make Tom and Jerry batter, you have to whip the egg whites stiff, and then you add sugar to it, and you blend this lovely white frothy meringue, and then you add spices of nutmeg and cinnamon and cloves, and this, you know, they get bound up in that. And then you add the egg yolks, and this is all raw.
Okay, okay.
Now you take a tablespoon of this lovely, you know, spicy mixture, and you put it in a cup, and then you pour boiling water. Hence, it gets cooked with the boiling water.
Oh, all right. It gets cooked.
It gets cooked during the boiling water, but you keep it frozen in the fridge or, you know, in the freezer or in the fridge, and it'll last a long time. Well, in the freezer, it'll last a long time. In the fridge, a week, 3 days, you know, depending on temperature and where you have it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a really interesting drink in that after you mix it with the hot water, I like to add whiskey. But you could add any kind of other libation to it. If you don't want to do that, you don't have to. But there's a certain, like if you add bourbon, you know, like there's a certain flavor that comes out with all the spices. And if you want to make it richer, like a texturally thicker, then you can add eggnog to it.
Oh, this is In addition to. Now, see, I've always liked eggnog. And talk a little bit about eggnog.
Oh, I remember. Oh, I've actually made eggnog. It's just the most fattening thing you can ever imagine. It's, oh, my God. It's heavy cream and milk and eggs. And it's just, you could probably use it to make ice cream. It's like it's just like the pre-ice cream mix that if you make ice cream at home, but it's with all the different spices, the same stuff that you would use for the Tom and Jerry batter, which is nutmeg, cinnamon, cloves, and you can add ginger to it and things like that. And it's all the variations of that, but, you know, and add more libations. It's just one of those. Yeah, very.
Oh, so the
cool
eggnog is usually, eggnog by itself is a cold sort of thing. And Tom and Jerry is usually a warm.
Yeah, it's a hot drink.
Oh, it's nice to have. And here I thought, you said Tom and Jerry was named after a play in the middle 1800s.
I don't know if it was named after a play, but the recipe was used as an advertising thing for the play. I don't know the whole history behind it. It's just I googled it a few years back and I read it and it was like, whoa, this is, you know, I wanted to know. And yeah, it was interesting. But I was thinking like this must go back to, you know, England or Europe.
Yeah.
No.
Good. It's an American thing. And here
it's very American.
And here I thought Tom and Jerry was named after the cartoon characters of my youth.
No, it's drunken people in North Dakota.
Oh, very good. Very good.
You know, northwest, you know, northern parts of the state of the United States.
Sounds like a really good way to ring in the new year, perhaps.
You know, I think those hot drinks that have stronger alcohol in it are very popular for people living up in colder climates. And this is just one of those things. If you're, you know, whatever you choose to do, I would recommend you have a plan because it can hit you really quick. But yeah, have a plan. Yeah, be careful. And
that's true.
So
that's true. Be careful. Although I was really glad to find that there are hot sort of toddies and
yes.
things for the winter time, because I thought I downhill skied for quite a bit of my younger days, and when I was learning to ski, I was in my late 20s perhaps, and the best part was the going to the chalet for a little something. Now I like this sport. Yes, I do.
Oh, so, like mulled wine or
yes,
hot.
Yes, mulled wine. Yeah. Hot buttered rum.
Yeah.
Oh, see?
This is on par with that hot buttered rum.
Oh, very
good. But it's
good.
More, it's the egg makes it frothy on top. And yeah, there's no butter in it that I know of.
Okay.
So there you go. Calorie wise, it doesn't have the dairy load that eggnog does because
yeah.
it's pound for pound. If you,
oh,
yeah,
see, so Tom and Jerry, yeah. let's be good to ourselves and look it up and give it a try.
Yeah, I would recommend giving it a try. It's just if you can make them a meringue, you can make Tom and Jerry batter.
Thank you, Cynthia.
You're very welcome. Happy holidays, folks.
That was about Tom and Jerry. Tom and Jerry, the drink. It was named after the play, Tom and Jerry, or Life in London, produced in 1821. So there you have it. We had a wonderful visit with Wheatsfield's cheese lady, Connie Lawrence, early in the show here. A lot of good things to say about cheese. Good time of year for cheese. We also visited with Barb and Michael Morris from Treats on a Leash, and thanks to Cynthia McClurg for her thoughts on Tom and Jerry's. We'll go out with a little music from Scandinavia by the band called Spilliminnear. I had to play the music just because I like to say the name of that band, Spilliminnear. Also, earlier in the show, we had music by Al and Alita Murphy, fine Iowa musicians. We heard the tunes Ice on the Road and the Snowflake Reel. This is the Donalana Kitchen. You can hear more of the Donalana Kitchen. This show is repeated in the evening at 7 o'clock. We're live on Tuesday at noon, and it's repeated at 7 o'clock. We can go to khoifm.org and download podcasts there from our show and from lots of other stuff. There's lots of other stuff. Support this radio station. That also has a wonderful magic button called Donate Now. We get by with a little help from our friends here. My name is Lana Nachtigal. We've had excellent engineering by Rick Morrison. Eat good food and enjoy life.